Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 4th, 2016, Labor Day weekend. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta and Dragon Con, home of Dragon
and
Con.
Welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yeah, good to have y'all both on, and we're going to discuss all kind of topics. Here in about 20 minutes, just to set up the podcast, Evan Siegfried, who is the author of GOP GPS, a book talking about how the GOP needs to get millennial voters, urban voters, most likely a more racially diverse electorate, so the Republican Party can survive. That's his thesis of the book. We'll discuss that and other things with Evan here in about 20 minutes. But until then, we're going to talk about election 2016. And I guess a lot of the news this past week was talking about how Donald Trump's had a lot of events, including one on both sides of the Mexican border, which he kind of said very different things. But yet Hillary Clinton has had very, very few events. I think this past week it was like Donald Trump had four events to every one event of Hillary Clinton's. Tim, what do you make of this? What's the reason?
You know, I've been scratching my head about it. The official line is that she has been going around raising money at a lot of private fundraisers, and you did see the result of that, that she set a fundraising record in August. It was just a massive cash flow into the campaign, which she was able to share with the DNC and you know, some other folks. And surrogates have been out on the trail, you know, carrying the water, as it were. The vice presidential candidate, Kane, has been out there, and some others, like
Joe Biden,
Vice President Biden. She did one major event this past week in Cincinnati. I believe it was at the American Legion convention. But it's gotten me a little worried because Trump seems to have found his footing out on the campaign trail. He is very scripted now. He almost looks like a reasonable person, and he is starting to go into her wheelhouse. He's in Detroit yesterday, you know, campaigning in black neighborhoods. And it's showing a little bit in the polls. The polls have really tightened up. She's lost half the lead that she had 3 weeks ago. She's behind a little bit now in states like Iowa. You might as well say a couple of states that it looked like we were going to compete in, like probably Missouri is off the table now, for now, as is South Carolina. And if this downward trend continued, she would be in danger of losing her total lead in both North Carolina and in Ohio within a week. So, you know, it's not as sure a thing as it was. I hope there was some grand reasoning behind this. You know, the rumor mill has swirled everywhere. But, Catherine, you take a crack at this and see if you can figure it out.
Well, you know, I'm just guessing, but I think, you know, I think that the traditional start of full-on campaigning, and I say this is traditional, it doesn't mean it really resonates this year, because this year is not very traditional in my eyes anyway. has always been Labor Day. You know, I think that's when we, you know, the momentum starts to build. People start to be interested. Summer's pretty much over in most places, and people are, you know, starting to think more about the election. So let's I'm hoping that she's looking at it that way and her campaign is looking at it that way, and that we'll see a big upswing in appearances and, you know, maybe some updated ads. I haven't seen any ads lately here in the Atlanta market. I did see some throughout the summer, but yeah, maybe I'm not watching as much TV. That could be. I've been a little bit worried about it too. I would not go so far as to say that Donald Trump seems to be reasonable, but that might be my bias. But let's hope that, you know, she looks at this traditional start of a camp of the, you know, the sort of high energy campaign of Labor Day. And let's hope that we see more of her. And I mean, I think her surrogates are helpful, but we need to see her too.
Yeah, and I think y'all alluded to the rumor mill. Now, obviously, the rumor mill is, oh, she's in such poor health. Well, she went through an entire primary campaign with a very rigorous schedule, showed no effects. If you saw the convention speech, she stood out there on a stage by herself on TV for, I guess it was roughly an hour, may have been slightly under, but showed, I wouldn't think, any effects. And so I think that's just some kind of, it's more of the alt-right conspiracy, but then it does dovetail nicely into that conspiracy that she didn't have any events. But then if they release and say, hey, she had X number of fundraisers every day and she gave a speech at each, she stood up and shook hands at each for no telling what, she traveled here, there, and everywhere, that would dispel it with any reasonable people. Now, she could go out and run, you know, the next marathon, and there's still going to be those detractors that want to believe it will believe that, you know, health story, if you will.
You know,
go ahead, Catherine.
The other thing is that I think all of us saw Donald Trump sort of spiraling down for the last couple, until this past week, right? Every time he opened his mouth, he said something stupid. And so maybe they were saying, well, you know, maybe we can just let him, you know, spiral and, you know, not say anything for a while. Obviously, you can't do that for very long, but there may have been some plan in that way. But now that he is, you know, like Tim said, you know, he's whittling it away at the lead that she had, so it's time to step up, get out there.
Oh yeah, and I think she's spending some time on debate prep early. Now, she may have learned that lesson from 2012 with President Obama in the first debate. She may think, well, more people are going to watch this debate than are going to follow politics in the last week of August. So let's pull back and do some debate prep. That, you know, that's a strategy. And if she does, you know, just dynamic well in the first debate, you know, we could say that paid off, because we don't think Donald Trump's a real studier. Even the people close to him, like Roger Stone, won't say that. Now, let's talk about Donald Trump's week. The biggest news story was the visit to Mexico and then the speech in Arizona. It was like Jekyll and Hyde. He said completely different things on the each side of the border. It was almost like they thought they could target the news. It was like, oh, well, for these moderate Republicans that were in swing voters, we need to bring back on our side that this harsh language has hurt us with. We're going to visit with the president of Mexico and be diplomatic. But then, so our base voters that like a lot of the wall talk won't, you know, become disillusioned, I'm going to give a hardline speech back in Arizona. Tim, what in the world was
day.
He doing there? On the same day,
well,
exactly. I mean, it was, yeah.
Here's the gist of it. They sent him down there to make him look presidential, like he could stand alongside world leaders. You know, that, how much more presidential can you look like that? And it was working like a charm until, and Rudy Giuliani, on one of the talk shows, confirmed this, and he was not happy about it. The deal was neither Trump or the president of Mexico were supposed to even talk about what they talked about in private. Well, of course, both of them did. And the problem with that is each one of them had a different recollection as to what was said, like about the thing about, you know, paying for Trump's absurd wall. And then, as you said, he comes back and he says, oh, we're going to have this big speech on immigration. I'm going to lay out of this. And it was more the old hardline rhetoric that he had been talking earlier in the year with really nothing new. So I don't think that went as well as they had hoped, except for one thing, David. I want to bring this up right now. Every time I turn the news on, and I turn it on a lot, I mean, on National Public Radio when I'm on my way to work, and the news here at home, that the first political thing out of their mouths, out of the announcer's mouth, is the words Donald Trump.
Yep.
Sometimes Hillary Clinton has not even getting mentioned lately. It's like he's running against a vacuum. In a vacuum, something's going to fill that vacuum up, and it's him. So,
I mean, he drives the ratings, and even though it seems like it, you would think in most elections, while one party's nomination might be more interesting than the other, once it comes time for the general election, the coverage is 60-40, 55-45, if it's not 50-50, and that's not changing over, and it's not like the Clinton campaign seems to be as worried as one would think. Catherine, why do you think the coverage hadn't evened up a little more?
Well, I don't know, but I watch Good Morning America pretty much every morning, every weekday morning while I'm getting ready for work, and I listen to NPR either on the way to work or in the shower or whatever. So I listen to both. And it seems to me, and I don't know if this is true or if it's just that – I don't know if it's just that Trump is so interesting to them, or if Hillary isn't – if Secretary Clinton and her campaign are not making themselves as available as Trump does. I mean, he's basically on the phone or in the studio or live on camera almost every day. And I just don't know if that's because he's just making himself available and that it's something they can fill the time with, or if they've chosen and that the Clinton campaign isn't, or if they've just chosen not to cover her. I don't think they would choose not to cover her.
If they were both fireworks, Hillary Clinton would be a sparkler. I mean, it's predictable. It does what it's supposed to do. But we've seen it. We've seen it so long. And Donald Trump's like a whistle chaser. You know, I mean, it's making noise and going every which way, and it's unpredictable. Maybe that's the more exciting firework, Tim.
Well, one thing I think this new campaign staff of his has done is at least talked him into the notion that, you know what, win, lose, or draw, you need to be all in. Right now, his campaign has the appearance, for better or worse, of being totally obsessed with winning this race. I mean, they are all in. While her campaign has given off the appearance, once they built the big lead in the polls, playing a strategy of running out the clock. And, you know, it's great, except for one thing, like the newspaper article I read said the other day, it's hard to run out the clock when the other guy is carrying the ball. So, you know, I really wish she would get back out there and get rolling. You know what, guys? We're going to see a big barrage of polls right after Labor Day, a bunch of them. They're going to let us know where they are. And if this thing is even tighter, well, then we have at least got to entertain the possibility that a trend is setting in his favor.
I mean,
and once they do, those are hard to reverse.
Well, and also we have to begin to compare the live caller polls with the non-live caller.
Right.
After
right.
what we heard 2 weeks ago from Tom Jensen, they had some polling come out of Wisconsin, and I paid special attention to that, not so much that, oh, where is Wisconsin's electoral vote going to go, not that they're not important, but because of what he said, those people pick up the phone. You think those probably a little more reliable than, say, Nevada, where he says they don't pick up the phone. Well, let me switch gears again before Evan calls in. And one hit me today, an article I sent y'all. The Richmond Times-Dispatch endorsed for president, and they endorsed Gary Johnson. Now, y'all know more about the history of the paper, but I did remember that Tim Kaine was mayor of Richmond, Virginia. Andy was governor of Virginia, so I thought that was a little surprising in that, and they endorsed this early. Tim, what can you tell us about that?
Well, this paper is very conservative. They historically endorse Republicans. They have not endorsed a Democrat in 40 years. Starting with Ronald Reagan in 1980, they have endorsed every Republican candidate for president. Their reasoning this year is, first of all, they're not going to endorse Hillary Clinton. That wasn't going to happen if she was running against Satan and the owner of the newspaper was her vice presidential candidate. Their thing is they want a conservative, and they say that Donald Trump ain't it. And apparently Governor Johnson met with their editorial board a week ago, and they were sufficiently impressed enough with him. They think he looks presidential, acts presidential. He doesn't have the baggage that the others have, and they pretty much indicated it was an easy decision to endorse him. So it would have been more of a coup for Donald Trump in Kaine's home state to have won this endorsement, but he did not. Gary Johnson did.
Yeah, home city even, because Mayor Richmond. Well, Catherine. Well, actually, let's go ahead and change gears again before we discuss that more. Welcome our guests. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine, Mr. Evan Siegfried. Welcome, Evan.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you on. Well, Evan, we talked about your book, but let's go before you wrote the book and kind of start off on the Kudzu Vine here for our listeners and tell us about your background.
Well, I'm a native New Yorker, so I've lived in New York City for the majority of my life, except for some stints in Vermont, Maine, and D.C., and I grew up a Democrat, actually. And as I grew up and got older, I started to realize all these promised solutions that Democrats kept on saying they would implement were actually just making problems worse. And I found myself going from excitedly voting for a candidate to voting against candidates to the Republican Party, and I'm very glad to be a part of it now.
Yes, so I think it was reading a little bit about your book, and you're a New York City Republican, which that's as rare as Tim and I, two white, Southern-born and bred Democrats. you know, not the old-school ones either, the progressive type. So we kind of understand your journey on the flip side, if you will. Well, let me start off, and then I'm going to pass it to Catherine and Tim, who are my co-hosts here. And you wrote a book, GOP GPS, talking about how essentially the Republican Party seems to need to diversify to exist. Why did you write the book, and then what's kind of the main thesis of it?
Well, I started looking at how Republicans are going to win elections in upcoming election cycles. And I began to get very worried when I started looking at the demographic numbers. We were not connecting with millennials whatsoever, and we were not connecting in urban areas. And the Census Bureau says that urban residents make up 80% of the United States population, and that millennials are now the largest generation in the United States. They've overtaken baby boomers. So Republicans have consistently relied on baby boomers and rural voters to win elections, except when those populations are dwindling, and every statistic shows that, and we're not doing anything to prep for when they're gone, that creates a big problem for Republicans in the future. So I wrote this partially as a warning sign, and then also as a way that we can start a conversation on how do we start attracting millennials, because in my view, millennials are actually tailor-made for the Republican Party. They are the most fiscally conservative generation since the Great Depression. They believe in personal liberty and personal responsibility. So if we can go out and combat the caricature of Republicans being this party of the crusty old white guy who's only looking out for the rich, and actually have substantive conversations about issues of education, the economy, entitlements, debt, and national security, I think that we'd be all better off.
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Catherine, and then she'll pass it to Tim for more questions. Catherine?
Hey, Evan, thanks so much for being on, especially over Labor Day weekend. We really appreciate it. Sometimes we have trouble.
You assume I have a life. I don't.
Well, yeah. Well, obviously, neither do we. I guess my question is, I think one of the big millennial questions or concerns as far as the Republican Party is the social conservatism of the current GOP. I think the millennials that I know, and granted there aren't that many, are much more open-minded about, women's health, the LGBT community, a little bit more concerned about the environment, a lot more concerned about the environment, I should say. And Republicans have traditionally been very conservative in those areas. And how can the party attract those millennials without forsaking those values that they've always embraced?
Well, I actually write about this a great deal in GOP GPS. I talk about how millennials overall, 75% of them believe in marriage equality. Of Republican millennials, 66% believe in marriage equality, and it's only growing. So while some people in the Republican Party, be they older or younger, might not believe in gay marriage, there are many more that believe that, well, we might not agree with it, it's not something for us to be able to say. It's sort of like the First Amendment. I don't think that it's a good idea for people to go around and say they are Boston Red Sox fans, but I can't stop them as a Yankees fan. So I know that's sort of minimizing the issue.
I'd just like to interrupt for 1 second and say that while marriage equality is very important, it is certainly not the only issue facing the LGBT community. There's a lot of discrimination, a lot of health inequalities, a lot of financial inequality. So I think marriage equality is kind of resolved. It might not be, everybody might not be happy about it. But
well, the way I look at it is this. Look at the Republican Party platform in July and how we basically changed two words about gays and lesbians. And I was very hopeful that we would take this, the Republican Party's or the Republican National Convention, and use the platform as an opportunity to show that we are not a group that is hostile toward the LGBT community. Yes, they do have problems where they are systemically targeted in hate crimes, and I think that's absolutely ridiculous. To me, if you are targeted because of your race, your color, or your sexual orientation, it is absolutely inexcusable and intolerant. And as a Republican, it goes with my Republican values to stand up for the LGBT community.
And I think that's great. But you're a Republican from New York, which is not that much different, honestly. Not that much different than some of our Democrats here in Georgia, honestly. But in the South and in the Midwest, I think you'll find a lot. I understand what you're saying, but I'm just wondering how you keep your loyal Republicans while embracing some of the values of the millennials. I see that as a
It is complex and it is a difficult thing to do. But what we could do, the way to start is to soften the party's language toward the LGBT community. It's not going to be something that's a switch that's flipped overnight and it's instantly accepting among all these conservatives, especially social conservatives. What we can do is discourage that. We can say it's okay to view them or say what they're doing is something you don't agree with. But we have to discourage them from speaking out about how they do that and demonizing them. I think it's inappropriate and it's wrong. And the more Republicans that do it, I know Republicans across the country, they're from California to Florida and back, and they are becoming much more tolerant and realizing this is a big problem because, you know, everybody has somebody who's a gay or lesbian in their family, and we still invite them to Thanksgiving dinner. We still have a good time with them, and we'll still argue about stuff over the Thanksgiving dinner table, but it'll be normal family stuff, not, oh, well, you're a member of the LGBT community. It takes time and it takes effort, and I am hopeful that we can go out and show that we are devoted to the LGBT community.
Great. That's great. I'm glad to hear it. I mean, I find it a little bit complicated, but, you know, it's complicated. It's American government. It's complicated.
Why do you think I'm for small and limited government? Because it's much simpler.
I'm going to go ahead and hand it to Tim, and if we come back around, I might have some more questions.
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for being on with us tonight. Yeah, I'm really a dinosaur. You talk about yourself being a New York Republican. I'm a New Deal liberal. There's like, what, five of those left alive in the United States? So
I think you, John Dingell, and
yeah,
that's about it.
A couple of labor leaders, and there we go. I'm going to broaden the question about millennials. Do millennials presently see the GOP as a party of the past? And if so, why is that?
Very simply, they absolutely do. They view it as the party of the crusty old white guy that's promoting these policies of the past, sort of wishing for that old school time that never existed that everybody's nostalgic for. To be honest with you, the cause of that is many different things. It's partially because we have never really attempted to bring millennials into the fold up until now. Traditionally, Republican strategists and operatives and activists have looked at millennials and said, oh, they're just a whole bunch of college kids in their basement smoking pot and playing video games and blogging, and they never go out and see the sun. They never took them seriously. Well, the problem is millennials are now having families of their own. They're concerned about education. They're concerned about national security. They're concerned about student debt. They're concerned about the economy. Democrats recognize this much sooner than Republicans did. And you have people like Bernie Sanders, whom I do not agree with, but what he did, which was very smart in his campaign, was he went out and he spoke to the issues that were pressing on millennials' minds. In 2015, any millennial graduating from college graduated with an average of $35,000 in student debt. And when you have a candidate like Bernie Sanders who comes along and says, hey, there's this problem you have and I want to solve it for you, in my opinion, his solution wasn't right, but he was the only one going out and talking about it, which was a good step. Unfortunately, Republicans didn't take advantage of that and say, well, wait a second, we have solutions. We can talk about why the cost of college at public universities is going up and the quality of education isn't at all, but we chose to instead mock and dismiss millennials and say, oh, you know, all they care about is free stuff, and their messiah in Bernie Sanders is just a joke. So we sort of shot ourselves in the foot on that one.
Another group I'd been wondering about are people of color. You've seen the statistics that the Hispanic vote is growing at a rate of about 1% of the electorate in each and every election for the past several cycles. You've seen the polling from people like our friend Tom Jensen, who actually registered Trump at zero popularity with African Americans running fourth in the country. With African Americans, and it seems that the Republican Party recently has not been, shall we say, more aggressively promoting an effort to reach out to people of color where they might find some natural allies, especially on a lot of domestic issues regarding the economy. Why do you think that appears to be that way?
Well, it goes back to sort of millennials. We've sort of ignored it and stuck to the we're comfortable winning elections with baby boomers and rural voters, sort of this white coalition, so to speak. And I worked on Joe Lotta's mayoral campaign here in New York City against Bill de Blasio. One of the smartest things he did was he went in October of 2013, when we were knowing we were going to lose by 30-plus points, he went to a march for charter school families, and the march was going over the Brooklyn Bridge to New York City's hall, or New York City Hall. And what was amazing was these were mostly minority parents and families there, and they see this old white guy come up who's, you know, he's a little pudgy, he's got some glasses, and he says, "Hi, I'm Joe Lotta, I'm a Republican running for mayor, and I stand with you. How can I help?" And when they hear that, they say, "Whoa, wait a second. This isn't the caricature of the Republican. He's actually asking how he can help. He's not telling me how he's going to help. He's asking how." And when they saw that and heard that, the message was so well received, and people started to question in this rally what was going on. Now, that's just one rally, and only 10,000 people attended that. But if we keep doing that, we can show that we actually have a commitment to minority issues. Take Black Lives Matter, for instance. I actually think that we can go out and talk with those communities because we all want the same thing. We don't want to have people feel threatened in their own communities, be it by police, criminals, or anybody else. So with Black Lives Matter, I actually think we can go and use the issue of police body cameras because that would be common ground. I believe that police body cameras are both pro-cop and pro-Black Lives Matter. They keep cops honest, and they keep people honest from making false accusations against the police. There is a ton of false accusations made against cops at every instance. So an objective observer in the form of a police body camera would be good, and it's something Black Lives Matter has been calling for. So if Republicans picked up that and championed it, that would help. Or if we went out and, in terms of women, we have this caricature that we're perpetuating a war on women. Believe me, it is completely fictitious, but unfortunately, it's something that is being used as a Democratic talking point. Republicans can go out and talk about how women are most negatively impacted in the workforce and economically when they are the ones who are being the primary care providers for our aging relatives who, when they enter that final phase of life, women will either take a lower paying or lesser job so that they have more work time flexibility to go out and take care of that relative, or they'll leave the workforce entirely. And it takes billions upon billions of dollars out of the economy every year. So if Republicans went out and championed some form of paid family leave, that would help, because once that relative actually passes away and the woman tries to re-enter the workforce, they've been gone for 1 to 3 to 4 years, and nobody wants to hire them. So we need to find a way to help women to be able to get back into the workplace, and men if they do it as well, because end-of-life care is not something that's being talked about. It actually sucks money out of the economy, and nobody wins.
All right. Thank you, sir. David?
Yeah, just another question, too, about the book before we move on to this campaign. Some of your titles, Netflix and Chill, We'd Meet in a Phone Booth, if they still existed. Where did you come up with some of these catchy titles?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm an older millennial myself. And, you know, I wanted to just sort of have a little fun, because at what point is it – let's be honest. My book, it can be a little dry because I'm talking about policy. I want to still keep you entertained, and – I want to be able to have you hear just sort of funny things, like Focus on the Family is my pro-family section where I talk about what I just spoke about with the war on women. Netflix and Chill, every millennial knows what Netflix and Chill is. Hopefully you guys do too, because it would be awkward for me to explain it right now. but I just thought, let's have some fun. You know, we're talking about very serious issues, but at the same time, life – if you take life so seriously throughout the entire time and don't have room to smile and laugh, then I think you're doing it wrong. So that's why I came up with those different chapter titles. I think that while we are talking about things that are serious, I want this book to also be more conversational, like I were explaining this to a good friend of mine that I might not agree with. You know, we'd be doing it over a beer or a glass of wine, and trading back and forth little barbs and having funny little sayings.
Yeah, well, next question I have about the book, it's in hardcover. And listening
yes.
to you on this podcast, you've got a great voice to listen to. Is there an audiobook planned?
I hope so. I am going to be speaking with my publisher, depending upon sales. It came out 12 days ago, really. So we're still seeing how the reception is. The reception's been great. The Conservative Book Club made it an editor's pick of the month, which I'm very excited about. Mike, the millennial news organization, which rivals BuzzFeed, is calling it one of the greatest solutions out there. It's even made its way to New Zealand in their big Sunday paper, and they called it the perfect solution for a modernized Republican Party that can actually talk about issues. So I'm very happy with the reception. I know I'd be personally happier if this were a New York Times bestseller because I have a mortgage to pay, but so that's where it's at, and hopefully I will be able to get an audiobook out for you guys.
Okay, I'm giving them an endorsement saying that you're the voice for the job, being the author. Well,
but the face for radio, trust me.
Well, let's move on to the this election, and you've had some thoughts both on your Twitter feed and some articles that got published, I think, back in May about Donald Trump and where he takes the Republican Party compared to your vision. Tell us about that contrast.
Well, I was never Trump from the get-go. I looked at Donald Trump, and everything he said and did offended me and demonstrated that he lacks the judgment and temperament required to be president of the United States. I don't understand how people can turn around and see him and say, this guy's so amazing, he's going to fix everything. It's just not based in reality. Some of his voters have legitimate frustrations because they've been left behind economically, but he's not the answer to their problems. I have written extensively about the Republican Party's need to diversify and broaden. Donald Trump not only is the antithesis to conservatism because he goes out and wants to essentially be the government, and I believe in a smaller government where very little power is divested among all elected officials, but he also is pushing away every group Republicans need. Look at who he's attacked. He's attacked Megyn Kelly for being a woman. He's attacked John McCain for getting captured. He attacked the federal judge, Judge Curiel, because he has Mexican heritage and said, oh, he can't make a fair and impartial ruling due to his genealogy. That's absolutely ridiculous. There's a federal judge in Brooklyn who ruled on the very famous Swiss bank cases about the Nazis when they hid all the Jewish gold and seized property in the Swiss banks after the Second World War. He's the judge who ruled on that and ruled in favor of the survivors and ancestors of the people who the Nazis stole it from. The judge is Jewish, and therefore, under Trump's own definition, he couldn't have provided a fair and impartial ruling. So it really offends me. He's gone out and offended every group, including the disabled. And when I think of America and who we want sitting in the Oval Office, I want somebody who's going to go out and champion the little guy and not mock them and attack them when they say something bad about them. I think you need to have an incredibly thick skin, to be president of the United States. And Donald Trump demonstrates an incredibly thin skin. Also, what has very much disturbed me is his outreach to the so-called outright or alt-right. I will call them what they are, white nationalists. I don't like to call them the alt-right. They have risen up and they view Trump as some sort of way to end this so-called white genocide, which is going on, and kick out the foreign hordes, as they say. It is very disturbing, and I think they should not be a part of the Republican Party or the political process. Their values are not Republican, and their values are not American.
Yes. Well, I'm going to have one more question before I pass it around to Catherine and Tim, and that would be every election, if it's a wave election or a trend, there's that campaign that runs, it's like a famine, runs against the stream. Back in 2002, I remember how Republicans won almost everything, but Mark Pryor was able to be elected to the Senate for the Democrats in Arkansas. I'm sure there's many more cases we could point to. What, like Senate seat, House seat, what do you think is going to happen this election cycle that's going to be that campaign that more embodies your book than the national scene?
Well, Right now, I'm not seeing any candidates on my side of the aisle who are embodying those values 100%. And I'm kind of glad because I don't want I think that's good that people have different ideas and different views. I think that there is somebody who is a good man in Mark Kirk in Illinois. He's facing a very tough reelection bid against Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. And he actually started running ads attacking Donald Trump. That coming from a sitting Republican U.S. senator in Illinois saying Donald Trump is not right for America, and he's the only Republican who's doing that. You're going to see more and more Republicans launching ads either doing that or saying they are the person that you want in Washington to protect voters against Hillary Clinton. No Republican that is sane is going to be tying themselves to Donald Trump. They don't want to have this sort of contagion or taint that Trump is giving them because it will hurt them once the fever breaks, hopefully by November 9th, and America has woken up to what Donald Trump is and should never be. I think that there are many within the Republican Party right now who are not up for reelection, but are elected officials who have bravely stood up and said, no, this man is wrong. He should not be there. You see Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who is very conservative, but very tolerant of other views. He stood up and said, Donald Trump is not qualified to be president of the United States. I will never vote for this guy. I'm like the vast majority of America, dissatisfied with both presidential candidates, and he's probably going to write somebody in. And I think he has a bright future in the Republican Party. There are others in the Republican Party whom I believe are trending there. Today, we had Jeff Flake come out and say that he still would not vote for Donald Trump at this point, and he's been waiting for months upon months for Trump to do something to actually get him there. And Trump's response this afternoon was to attack Jeff Flake on Twitter and call him a lightweight, say the Republican Party doesn't need him. And when you're seeing poll after poll where Republicans are very unsure of Trump and they're just saying they're going to stay home, attacking a well-respected member of the party is the exact opposite way of bringing them into the fold.
Yes, well, I'll go ahead and pass it to Catherine and then to Tim. Catherine?
Thanks. I'm back. I read a lot about these Never Trump people. I guess you are one of them. And I did see your I would not call it an endorsement, but your comments that you back in May said you would vote for Hillary Clinton, and I appreciate that. But I see a lot of comments from Never Trump people who say, well, they're going to write somebody in, or they're going to vote for the libertarian, or they're going to vote for this new guy. But ultimately, if you're Never Trump, you really have to support Secretary Clinton, don't you? I mean, if you really don't want to see Donald Trump be president, then the logical path is to vote for Hillary Clinton. As much as you may not agree with her, but if Donald Trump is such a loathsome fellow, then it seems to me, and now granted I'm biased, I've been a Hillary Clinton supporter since forever. But how do you resolve? I mean, I don't think it's a question for you, but more for those other Never Trump people.
Well, it's very hard, to be honest with you. For a quarter century, Republicans have said that everything that the Clintons do is bad, and it's been the one constant narrative. Republicans attack Clintons. And to then turn around and ask them to vote for Hillary Clinton is very tough. It's like trying to maneuver a luxury cruise liner and make it do a very hard 180-degree turn in 30 seconds. It's not going to happen. So there are Republicans who are going to go out and vote for people like Gary Johnson and Evan McMullen, whom I actually like a great deal, not just because his first name is Evan. But there are Republicans who are going to go out and vote down ticket for still Republican candidates. And I think that's why Evan McMullen's running. He knows he's not going to win, but he's doing this sort of kamikaze run to try and get conservatives out for any reason to go out and help these endangered Senate Republicans and House Republicans. I have talked to many people within the Never Trump community, and we don't like Hillary Clinton, but we each of us live in different states. So for me, in New York State, and there's another friend of mine who lives in another northeastern state, which is very blue. We both said that, you know, if the polling is really tight and really close, we're absolutely voting for Hillary because while we don't like her, we can't take that risk with Trump. But if the polling is showing a 10-plus point gap, then we'll be voting our conscience, as Ted Cruz urged us to do. And I'm no Ted Cruz fan, but I did like his RNC speech. The thing that we can do is we can talk to people about values, and we can say, listen, this is why we believe that Donald Trump shouldn't be president. Whenever somebody goes into a voting booth and casts their vote for a candidate, it's their sacred trust. They are saying, I believe in you, and I think this is the candidate for me. And I think that many people, especially in the Never Trump groups, we know that Donald Trump is an unacceptable solution and would absolutely destroy American politics and policy as we know it. We've seen that just from his policy proposals and his extreme views that are borderline xenophobia. We want
borderline. There's no borderline there.
Well, there's the wall which he built on the border of xenophobia, and, you know, he's making us Republicans pay for it. But we are pointing out all the negatives of Donald Trump, and I feel kind of liberated this election cycle because I can also turn around and say, well, Hillary Clinton has some negatives too, and here they are, and let people make up their own minds. I can only give them the information. I don't feel it's appropriate of me to turn around and tell somebody, you need to go into the voting booth and vote this way. That's counter to American values of my own. So I can put it out there. I can say this is why Donald Trump should not be voted for. And if people view that Donald Trump really is that bad, then they're either going to stay home or vote for Hillary Clinton or vote for one of the alternatives. And I don't think that you're going to get that many people in the Republican Party to vote for Hillary Clinton because of just how long and how often we've talked about how bad she is. It's very hard to turn around and say, well, she's better than Trump, and people to go out and listen.
Okay, that's really good. Thank you. That helped me to understand it. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, sir. I want to take this one a step further, too. I'm only give away my age a little bit here, but I worked in my first campaign 1968. I have volunteered at some level, mostly local, for 13 straight presidential elections. Of course, I am a New Deal liberal, but in each and every election, I always thought one thing, even with a guy like Nixon, who was crooked as a dog's hind leg. He was a man of some ability. His background showed that. The nominees for each party in every election I've ever been involved in, I could live with them being elected president because they were trained for the job, you know, by temperament and their background. For the first time in my life, I'm literally afraid of a presidential nominee. Am I right to feel that way about Donald Trump?
I think you just said what I was thinking, and I just haven't worked in 13 straight presidential election cycles because I'm not that old. To be honest with you, you're 100% right. Donald Trump does not have the experience, the judgment, or the temperament to be president. To me, being president, you have to demonstrate a record of being able to do things. And, you know, I've supported Mike Bloomberg for mayor in New York City, and he had never been training for that job whatsoever, but he came out and he said, I'm a businessman, and he laid out distinct policies and visions and understood what was going on. Now, contrast that to Donald Trump and his presidential run. Trump is being asked, well, what are you going to do? We're going to start winning again. How are we going to start winning again? We're going to make a deal. Well, how are you going to make a deal again? Because I'm a great negotiator. Why are you a great negotiator? Because I'm a great businessman. And then he pulls it right back to winning again. It's cyclical nonsense. And I don't think he has proven that, A, he understands the issues. He didn't even understand what the nuclear triad was. His immigration speech Wednesday night, he absolutely did not address a big problem of illegal immigration, which is that 40% of illegal immigrants enter the country legally so they could fly into any airport and then just overstay their visas, because we really haven't done a good job in tracking exits of visas. And Trump has not shown himself to be serious or fully understanding of the issues. You saw him say that that Putin was not in Crimea and hadn't annexed it. It's when you have a candidate who basically ignores common facts and doesn't understand them, that's not only scary, but it's dangerous. And I hope that we will recover, and the next presidential election cycle, Republicans will put up a nominee who, while you may or may not agree with their positions, you can say this person understands the issues. I just disagree with their approach to them.
Right. In recent days, a growing chorus of big-name Republicans in this country have pretty much begged Chairman Priebus to start shifting resources to down-ballot races. You know, for one thing, the Trump campaign, as other presidential campaigns have done, has not exactly raised a massive amount of money and shared it, you know, with the RNC to help out. Should Chairman Priebus...
You mean Trump would lie about the amount of money he has?
Should Chairman Priebus start looking at
for a new job? Yes.
Should he start looking at shifting resources to down ballot races in order to protect your majorities in the House and Senate?
Yes, the sooner Chairman Priebus does that, the better. I'm no fan of Reince Priebus because of the way he has acted and behaved towards Donald Trump, almost enabling him. If you guys are Game of Thrones fans at all, we like to call him in the Never Trump circles Reek, because he's basically been taken over by Trump. I'll let you guys Google that if you don't know that reference. But I think that the sooner that happens, the better it is for Republican candidates. You have so many Senate seats that are vulnerable right now. We're playing defense this election, and we would be even if we had a strong and competent nominee that weren't named Donald Trump. We've got Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire. We've got Mark Kirk in Illinois. We've got Marco Rubio in Florida, although that's seemingly getting better because Patrick Murphy has his own problems, his challenger. But we've also got Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. You've got John McCain, who has a problem I believe it's Ann Kirkpatrick in Arizona. This is going to be a very tough race for many Republicans, and it was going to be, and it's made infinitely harder because of Donald Trump. Donald Trump's campaign is now, because it has not built a field operation or really a digital operation or any sort of campaign apparatus other than, you know, going out and insulting people, Donald Trump's campaign is basically sucking as many resources as it can from the Republican National Committee. And Republicans have to stand up and say enough, because we need these very valuable assets to go out and help down-ballot Republicans, because that's what they were built for. If you look at how President Obama won in 2008 and 2012, he was building his own field operation and data operation from day one. He understood the importance of it, and forget the policies of the candidate. That's what candidates have to do to win. Hillary Clinton's saving grace, her negatives are going higher and higher, but the one thing that she has going for her is she has taken the Obama campaign apparatus, built upon it, and improved it. So when it comes time for Election Day, they're going to be able to get the voters out that they need to get out. And that's why I think she's going to win, and she's going to come close to 350 electoral votes. So Trump needs the RNC a lot more than the RNC needs him. Let's be honest. It's sort of this. The RNC should walk away and say, we're done with you. We've given you 2 months almost since the convention to really become a mainstream candidate. And you go down to Mexico on Wednesday. You have a pretty dour-looking press conference with the Mexican president. And to some extent, it did look more presidential than Trump has ever. And then he changes his immigration speech on the plane because he doesn't like that the Mexican president said that Trump was told that Mexico would not pay for the border wall. So you saw that short temper where he decided to say, and Mexico is going to pay for it. It was very thinly veiled xenophobia in that speech. and Republicans need to distance themselves. We saw it again today with him attacking Jeff Flake. At what point will Reince Priebus say enough and walk away?
That is an excellent assessment, the best one I've heard about this particular subject. As a matter of fact, thank you for that. And back
to you.
Close it out.
Yes. Well, Evan, I want to thank you for being on. I could continue to ask you questions the rest of the night, and I'm sure Tim and Catherine could too. So hopefully we can get you on, if not before Election Day, after Election Day, to kind of talk about how the election looked compared to your ideas in your book, possibly.
I would welcome that. That would be a lot of fun, although I don't know if I'm old enough to be on the podcast right now.
Okay,
yeah.
That's enough
well,
of the age.
Well, I'm a little younger, and I think my 13-year-old's on the podcast in the background, too. So you can probably hear her complaining. Well, let me go ahead and let you go, Evan, and then we'll close the show out.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it, and I hope everybody goes out and buys GOP GPS, How to Find the Millennials and Urban Voters the Republican Party Needs to Survive.
Yes,
thank
I'll
you,
be looking
sir.
For that audiobook. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, that was Evan Siegfried, and definitely. And check his Twitter feed out, just Evan Siegfried Twitter. It'll come right up. He's an incredibly frequent poster. And then one last thing before we go, because something lighthearted, something short. Dancing with the Stars announced their cast in the last week, and Rick Perry's going to be on the show. Now, Rick Perry has run for president twice. He served over two terms as governor of Texas. I just get the feeling that Rick Perry really, really likes the limelight. Catherine, do you get that idea?
Yeah, but my question is, what I really want is I want Rick Perry and Ryan Lochte to dance together in Dancing with the Stars.
If those two actually were the final two, I might have to cheer for Rick Perry over Ryan Lochte because that would be tough for me to pick. Do you watch Dancing with the Stars? I don't, but I know it's a big phenomenon.
I have seen it. I have a feeling coming episodes I'm going to be watching a little less of. I guess Rick Perry wants to be another Tom DeLay. Oh, his dancing career was tragically cut short, you know, by a leg injury and an indictment. So we have great hopes for Governor Perry that he'll be as suave on the dance floor as he is on the debate floor, right, guys? Yeah.
Yeah, I tell you what, I think the Dance of the Stars really loves Texas Republicans. I guess you could say they love Texas politicians, and then most of them are Republicans at the statewide level. But you know, and honestly, my favorite or one of my favorite reality shows that really didn't get enough attention, Work of Art, to find the next great artist. Maybe George W. Bush could bring that show back, and he could be one of the contestants. And I think that would be much more fascinating than watching Rick Perry, the person that succeeded him as the governor of Texas, dance. So who knows? Well, thanks again to Evan Siegfried. Go see, find out more about his book, GOP, GPS. You can buy it at Amazon, other places. And until next week, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.